I know you're disappointed. You were expecting that I might sing a solo, but I don't think she can play 16 tons, so let's sing this song.
Can't you get yourself in trouble?
She called my boss. Very good, Betsy. We'll begin our service with the opening hymn, printed in the order of service, which you'll find in your hymnals. Please stand. Fellowship of Winona. My name is John Collins, and Carol and I have been members for the last 10 or 12 years, and I serve on the Sunday Service Committee. If you're new to our fellowship, we especially welcome you. We hope you enjoy the service and find yourself challenged and supported for your work in the world. We invite you to stay for coffee and conversation after the service. Are there any introductions by our greeter or anyone who'd like to introduce themselves?
This is my daughter Amy from Morgan Assembly.
You want to say anything more about her?
No. She's a good
girl. Yes.
I'm Jesse Pollard. I'm here today from Minneapolis. Here to see my dad for a week or two while my mother's uptown.
Well, you must be a saint to be alone with that mask for a long period of time. Congratulations. A couple of announcements. Our fellowship board still needs volunteers to replace the board members who are cycling off. The board meets once a month to steer the business of our fellowship. Okay. Terms are for 2 years. If you're interested, talk to any of the current board members or to Jan. Current board members are Dan Poehler, Paul Sukop, Deb Ward, Bob Youngerman, Jeff Heima, Gail Opetz, and Ray Keeney, who's in New Mexico. Paul has an announcement.
It's reiteration from last week, too. I have the pledge forms over there. They'll be very helpful for me in help formulating the budget for next year. If you have a chance and fill that out and put it in the folder right next to it, I would greatly appreciate it. Thanks.
I saw a pledge form put in back there just earlier today, and that's when we ring one of these bells, isn't it?
Okay, good. We'll put the bell back there, so fill it out, put it in, get ring them.
Okay, good. All right.
Makes the treasurer happy.
Next Sunday's program is the 350 Organization versus Keystone Pipeline. Jim Armstrong will be showing a brief documentary about Bill McKibben and his organization, 350.org. They are the main organizers of efforts to block approval of the Keystone Pipeline. Afterwards, we will have a brief discussion of how the issue intersects with our Unitarian values. We will look at how to find wisdom, hope, and courage in McKibben's example. And did you want to add anything?
Well, I was just going to say, I'm going to show a little bit of the documentary, do the math, and then have this discussion. So it'll be a multimedia presentation.
And the important thing is, just how do the Unitarian principles apply to the situation? Okay. Thank you, sir. Today's program is Keeping Our Small Boat Afloat, and Brianna Mellum will be with us at some point in the morning. I emailed her earlier in the week. She said she'd be here, so I assume she'll be here. She's going to be using a recent poem from Minnesotan Robert Bly to guide this morning's program. She will share stories about the wisdom that comes from sacred words throughout the ages, along with the experiences of our everyday lives, both the mundane and the extraordinary. At this time, we'll affirm our fellowship by saying together the chalice reading as printed in the order of service. We have come together today. Now is the time to make this our place.
We are Unitarian Universalists. We like this chalice. It is our symbol. It represents all of the important things which make us who we are and which hold us together. Let us create our space together and make for ourselves a safe place to grow and learn and to be fully who we are.
Thank you. We'll please stand while we sing hymn number 188. Come, come, whoever you are. 188.
So this is a round. So what we'll do is we'll sing it twice all together so you can learn it, and then we'll divide up in hymns. We won't try four parts this morning. I think two will be good. Okay. So here's how it goes. I'm getting started now. So it goes. You can join in any time. Come, come, whoever you are, wanderer, worshiper, lover of leaving, ours is no care of and love of despair. Come, come, whoever you are, wanderer, worshiper, lover of leaving, ours is no care of and love of despair. Come, yet again come.
This side.
Come, come, whoever you are, wanderer,
place this shell in the water for principle number four, a free and responsible search for truth and meaning. We invite you now to place a shell in the water in celebration of or in concern for a person or an event in your life that we may share in your joy or give you comfort in your sorrow.
I've been teaching the kids about the first Unitarians and Universalists, and this principle is so important. We just don't appreciate how our freedom to choose what to believe. They died, they were put in prison, they were, their lives were ruined, their houses burned down. So we have to appreciate that principle.
Well, Dot came and visited us on our spring break, and I just wanted to put a shell in for how great it is to have your kids come home and have them, you know, basically okay and excited and loving their studies, and still like, okay, we did a good job.
I'll take a moment of silence for these joys and concerns, both spoken and those that were not spoken. If you have much, give your wealth and your heart. If you have little, give your heart. We will now share in the fellowship through these offertory basket opportunities. And if you're giving of your pledge, make note of that. Will the children please come forward for today's story? When the story is over, the children will leave for spiritual education. We will stand and sing to the children, "Go Now in Peace," as printed in the order of service. We'll sing it one time together and once as a round with the people on my right starting the round.
Well, do you think spring is ever going to come?
Well, we have grass.
We do have grass, too. And you can actually see it. He's a born optimist. Well, this is a story about some people who were wondering. It was almost spring. The air smelled like it. You have a dog. That's cool. The air smelled like it. The sun was warmer, and the calendar said that spring had come, but everything was still gray and bare and growing and budding, and spring had not come to the city. "There are no green signs of spring," someone sighed. "How dreary," groaned another. People looked as sad as the city. Across the street, a little boy who had been frowning just as hard as everybody suddenly smiled and said, "Hey, why wait for spring to change everything to grass and flowers? Let's change it ourselves right now." "How?" a lady asked. And the little boy told how, and everyone cheered. "Tell the mayor," they shouted. The next morning, after an exciting speech by the mayor, they paraded down the street behind a big brass band. Boys, girls, friends, neighbors, they all carried paint cans and brushes and ladders and scaffolds. And they painted climbing vines on the fences and daffodils on the houses. They painted flowers on the awnings over the store windows, and they painted lampposts and fire hydrants bright colors. On the big buildings, they painted fields of spring daisies with brooks and rivers, between the hills covered with dandelions, beside a lake. A sign said, "No fishing." I don't know why they put that. On the pillars in front of the bank, they painted bluebirds hunting for breakfast in make-believe grass. Pussy willows grew on mailboxes, and a border of tulips bloomed on the bakeries. Along the waterfront, the old piers soon looked like big moss-covered rocks, and they painted frogs on them. And giant mushrooms they painted on the big gas tanks. They painted buttercups on the bridge, and on the cars of the train running over it, were each a different color. Smokestacks, chimneys, factories, water tanks, towers, all changed from sad gray to happy green and yellow. Finally, everything that could be painted had been painted, and there was a bright, fresh, spring-like look everywhere. That's an improvement, don't you think? Oh no, but after the city had gone to sleep, it began to rain. It rained and rained throughout the night, and in the morning, from one end of the city to the other, the painted grass and flowers had all been washed away. But the rain had started everything really growing. Real vines and sprouts were coming up green in the gardens, and crocuses had pushed up through the earth. Tiny ferns had appeared like magic during the night. They looked pretty happy. Plants had started in the window boxes, and the trees lining the streets were covered with tender buds. On top of the old deserted barges in the river, grass grew, and dandelions, real ones, now were there. In the zoo, the animals went to their outdoor cages and sniffed the new thin grass covering the park. See, that camel is sniffing the air. Robins chirped, and lions and tigers stretched in the spring sun. They knew it had come at last. The boys and girls who had waited so long oiled their skates and polished their bicycles. Have you guys oiled your skates yet? Everything was awake and stirring as they looked all around them in the city. It was really spring!
Church back and you take a few moments to gather yourself.
I'm good.
Back in Columbia, Missouri, like 30 years ago, and the pastor, he'd been there many years. He wasn't there. He didn't show up, and so we sang for what we were going to sing. We sang for like 15, 20 minutes, and then he finally showed up, and he'd simply overslept. And he said, "I really felt like a goat." He said, but, "So you didn't have to feel that way today, Brianna." But Brianna, I wanted to just say a couple of words about her before she comes up here. That is, she's a social work major from Winona State University. Maybe that's all I should say. But she also went to an interesting seminary, and I want to know more about that someday, what that seminary was like. But more importantly, she's been kind of our spiritual advisor for the last 10 years or so, don't you think?
I was just thinking of that. I think something...
Yeah. And one thing she taught us was that really our journeys are about journeys of the heart, and we've been very grateful for that. And she's also taught us about working with themes, and our planning committee, we're very grateful for that. So we're grateful that you're here today, Brianna. Thank you.
And I think we should do a reprise of the Come, Come, Whoever You Are.
Yeah.
She requested it because the words are by Rumi, which you will refer to later. And we did such a good job of the round.
I was imagining that as I was driving down through the bluffs and imagining, oh no, I'm missing that song. So I have a question, which is the microphone on? And if I use it for playing you a piece, will you be able to hear it through the microphone?
We'll try.
Okay, let's give it a try. And if we have time to reprise, I'm all for it. I grew up with a Lutheran minister who It snowed so much one Sunday that he cross-country skied across town to get to church on time. So there were very few people, yeah. But he made it. Okay, so I'm going to play you a piece, which is a poem that Robert Bly wrote and read just a couple of years ago from his writing shack on his land. And this is a poem called Keeping Our Small Boat Afloat.
Keeping our small boat afloat. So many blessings have been given to us during the first distribution of light that we are admired in a thousand galaxies.
Should we turn it up? Yeah. There we go. Okay.
I'll sit here because I need feedback.
Yeah, it is starting to.
There we go.
Keeping our small boat afloat.
Good.
So many blessings have been given to us during the first distribution of light that we are admired in a thousand galaxies for our grief. Don't expect us to appreciate creation or to avoid mistakes. Each of us is a latecomer to the earth, picking up wood for the fire. Every night another beam of light slips out from the oyster's closed eye. So don't give up hope that the door of mercy may still be open. Seth and Shem, tell me, are you still grieving over that spark of light that descended with no defender near into the Egypt of Mary's womb? It's hard to grasp how much generosity is involved in letting us go on breathing when we contribute nothing valuable but our grief. Each of us deserves to be forgiven, if only for our persistence in keeping our small boat afloat when so many have gone down in the storm.
I've been watching some Robert Bly readings on YouTube recently, and he has this amazing way of participating in poetry readings where he will stop somebody and say, stop, say that line again. And he'll say, okay, we didn't get that. Read it again, slower. Okay, oh, there it is. And it's almost like listening to a gospel preacher and somebody in the audience is, you know, yelling amen to certain lines of the poem, or he'll stop himself and say, oh, I just couldn't get that word quite right, but. So let me read that last little stanza again. Each of us deserves to be forgiven, if only for our persistence in keeping our small boat afloat when so many have gone down in the storm. I'm going to tell you this story today of two different men who grew up about 10 miles apart in western Minnesota and whose lives took very different paths that eventually came to a crossroads. After they immigrated to America from Norway, Karen and Axel Gunderson settled in Chicago and had two sons. A short time later, Axel died, leaving Karen a widow with two small children. She worked for a while as a handmaid to Mrs. Ziegfeld, the wife of Flo Ziegfeld of the Ziegfeld Follies, pouring her milk baths with real milk, a terrible waste to a woman who had grown up on the farmlands of her home country. And then one day she saw an advertisement. A school teacher in Minnesota had been offered a land grant of 160 acres by the U.S. government if he agreed to leave his work and turn the land into crops and raise livestock, and he was looking for a housekeeper The U.S. government gave him 160 acres of free land, and I stopped to wonder whose land was that originally. So Karen answered the letter, and she and her sons, Carl and Marshall, were on their way to Minnesota, where Karen began to work for the school teacher turned farmer whose name was Matthew. Before long, Matthew and Karen were married, and he adopted her two sons, giving them his surname. And thus, young Marshall Gunderson of Chicago, Illinois, became Marshall Mellum of Dawson, Minnesota, where he spent the rest of his life raising his own three children, including my dad, Terry. It was not until my dad was in high school that he learned this story that his biological father had gone back to Norway to die, it was whispered, of syphilis. And that his grandfather, the grandfather that he had known his whole life, Matthew, had adopted Marshall as a small boy. Marshall was a bit of a surly character, as I remember him. He was easily annoyed by those clowns singing down by the park during the annual Riverfest celebration. The first time I heard someone swear, it was my Grandpa Marshall, upon learning my cousin and I had, I don't know how this happened. We locked ourselves in a closet, but we had locked the room to the closet during a particularly fierce game of hide-and-go-seek with our siblings. So we were in a locked closet in a locked room, and my cousin had to climb up a ladder in the window to get us out. And we heard my grandpa outside the door saying, "What the hell did they do that for?" We drove by a place where he was helping someone mow the lawn, and I crouched down in the back seat because I didn't want to see him after I heard him say that. I thought he was so angry with me. But every weekend he would drive down to the Dawson Bakery and bring home a white box filled with maple long johns and apple fritters. He and my grandma had a shelf along their staircase in their modest home, and it was lined with sparkling bowling trophies, prisms of blue and gold rainbows on marble slabs with their high scores etched onto little brass plates. He kept an immaculate garden, growing raspberries and apple trees, potatoes which he called spuds, and mounds of red and white impatiens, flowers along the sides of the house. He cut the grass of their corner lot with a riding lawnmower, and when we asked if we could ride it, he said, "That's not a toy, that's a dangerous weapon." It's a phrase that we still use to this day. Dawson has never been a hub of grand excitement. It is home to a soybean plant where my grandmother was a bookkeeper, which I thought had something to do with being a librarian. She kept the books, but yeah, she took care of the numbers, but I thought it meant taking care of books. They have an 8-room motel called the Picket Fence Motel, which these days keeps quotes to encourage you every day listed by Susie Orman. And along with that 8-room motel, its claim to fame on their tourism website reads that you will enjoy visiting there because of the many gnomes around town carved in honor of various local citizens. Every year a new gnome is unveiled, and if you visit our Central Park, you'll see our large collection of cement gnomes, and you'll want to stay the day. Once you visit Dawson, it says, you won't want to leave, which sounded a little bit like the Hotel California. You can check in, but you can't check out. As a kid walking independently a few blocks across the walking bridge over the Lochiparl River to the Ben Franklin dime store to buy plastic pencils that smelled like fruit was very exciting for a 10-year-old girl and her cousins. I loved the green covered candy dish on my grandparents' coffee table, which was always full of Andy's mints. And listening to my dad's uncles speak in their thick Norwegian accents. "So," Uncle Carl would say, "you hear they're going to pick the winners for the big raffle next week then?" "Oh yeah," Uncle Cliff would respond. "How's that then?" "Well, they're picking them at random." To which Cliff said, and I quote,
picking them at random. Where's that then? My dad was Marshall's middle child, and he was a quiet boy who spent evenings lying on his stomach examining maps of the United States, imagining all the places he would one day take road trips. But when it was time to choose what he was going to do after graduating from high school, my dad didn't go very far. He became an English major at the University of Minnesota Morris in the western part of Minnesota. And it was there that he became entrenched in the writer's scene of the late 60s, where poetry readings and parties with English professors were frequented by another resident of the next town over from Dawson, a small town called Madison, where the award-winning poet, essayist, and literary critic Robert Bly was living. Bly grew up in Madison on a farm he returned to after he spent time first as a student at Harvard with studying with fellow poet and feminist Adrienne Rich, and then he spent time as a Fulbright scholar in Norway translating Norwegian poetry. When Bly came back to his family's farm in 1958, he was with his wife, the writer Carol Bly, and their children, and he began publishing criticism of American poetry. He found the works of T.S. Eliot, who is from our tradition, intellectual and removed from personal emotion, and more from the point of an observer rather than participant in the wellspring of life he found in poets who were being more widely read in Europe, but much less known in America. He was a great critic of the early 20th century, the first half of the 20th century poets, and felt that they should become more personally vested and personally revelatory in their work. On his farm, Bly kept an old schoolhouse where he would write and publish this literary journal, which was first called the 50s and then the 60s, with a colleague who was based in Pine Island, Minnesota. I'm going to pause here and segue into the next part of this story in an unusual way because I couldn't figure out how to say it without just saying it. I was in a bathroom at the Turtle Bread Bakery on Chicago Avenue in Minneapolis recently. Of all places, there in the bathroom, there was a poem on the wall that stopped me dead in my tracks. I've been to Dawson lately, and the bakery is closed, and the Mellum farmhouse is torn down, and the empty buildings are sagging and unpainted. And when I read this poem, it was a visceral experience of being there, whispers of stories still hanging silently over the desolate land. And this is a poem that was in this Minneapolis restroom called Milkweed by James Wright. While I stood here in the open, lost in myself, I must have looked a long time down the cornrows beyond grass, the small house, white walls, animals lumbering toward the barn. I look down now, it is all changed. Whatever it was I lost, whatever I wept for was a wild, gentle thing, the small dark eyes loving me in secret. But it is here. At a touch of my hand, the air fills with delicate creatures from the other world. It was not until I was researching Robert Bly that I learned that poem was in fact written on the land, just a few miles from the abandoned farm where a school teacher and a widow fell in love and gave my family its name. That poet, James Wright, had read Robert Bly's criticism of the lack of personal connection in early 20th century American poetry, and he responded by typing a 6-page single-spaced letter full of both contrition, for he saw that tendency in his own work, and agreement with that criticism. Bly quickly handwrote an invitation to Wright to come and visit the farm. Wright had fallen into a period of despair. He was bipolar and alcoholic, his marriage was failing, and he had lost the will to write. Bly created a space for Wright to stay, where he began working in a new way, writing more personally and with a deeper connection to his own longing and inner awakening. During that time, his poetry changed drastically, and he wrote this, which is a particular favorite and I think one of his more well-known pieces. And I recall hearing it years ago when Garrison Keillor was reading it on the Writer's Almanac on public radio. And he speaks in this poem of a friend who is, in fact, Robert Bly. This poem by James Wright is called A Blessing. Just off the highway to Rochester, Minnesota, twilight bounds softly forth on the grass, and the eyes of those two Indian ponies darken with kindness. They have come gladly out of the willows to welcome my friend and me. We step over the barbed wire into the pasture where they have been grazing all day alone. They ripple tensely. They can hardly contain their happiness that we have come. They bow shyly as wet swans. They love each other. There is no loneliness like theirs. At home once more, they begin munching the tufts of spring in the darkness. I would like to hold the slenderer one in my arms, for she has walked over to me and nuzzled my left hand. She is black and white. Her mane falls wild on her forehead, and the light breeze moves me to caress her long ear that is delicate as the skin over a girl's wrist. Suddenly I realize that if I stepped out of my body, I would break into blossom. My dad met Robert Bly on several occasions, mostly at poetry readings and after parties. And once my dad worked up the courage to call the Bly farm and ask if he could share some of his writing in hopes of being published. Robert and Carol welcomed him enthusiastically and generously, and Robert made quick notes moving a word or changing a phrase and sent my father forth with words of great encouragement. And that spirit of generosity and encouragement was not an isolated incident. The Minnesota memoirist and poet Patricia Hampel said this: "I read Bly's magazine and his good-spirited but deadly attacks on the literary establishment, and I knew I was reading the future. It became known, I can't remember how, that if you sent a batch of poems to Robert Bly, he would reply, and he did, thoughtfully, promptly, generously, and with a fiercely honorable candor that alone can extend true respect to a beginning writer. A response like that can keep a young writer going. There are many of us who will never forget that generosity and the bracing experience of editorial honesty. It may be what's best about literary life here, and that spirit certainly began with Robert Bly." One time my dad and my grandpa Marshall were sitting in a small restaurant together, and my dad said, "Do you see that man sitting over there on the other side of the room? That's Robert Bly." And my grandpa Marshall had no idea who that was, but he scoffed and said, "How the hell can he be reading two books at one time?" My dad said he's translating poetry into English. So here are two men, both sons of Norwegian immigrants, both raised on farms just miles apart, both living in quiet, sleepy towns, a rather simple life, but they are on opposite sides of the room. One is a mailman, a postal carrier, a quiet curmudgeon who thinks reading two books at one time is showing off. And the other is a scholar, a wordsmith, a lover of language, and a great communicator. But they shared a belief that united them in ways that they did not know. Because my father was about to be called up for the draft to go to Vietnam. I just learned a lot of this, so it's still quite fresh. My father would have to stand before a group of six men to convince the draft board that he should be granted conscientious objector status, something that I was not allowed as a child to mention to any of my friends, lest people would hurt me or be cruel to my father. The two men who supported my dad in opposition to the war were poet and scholar Robert Bly and Private Marshal Norman Mellum, veteran of World War II, who was awarded a Purple Heart for injuries incurred in the midst of battle. When news of a potential draft in World War II reached my grandfather's generation, his friend convinced him they should enlist in the National Guard, as they'd be unlikely to be called up for duty quickly. Instead, my grandfather was among the first. He was given a Browning automatic rifle and stood with a group of other men on an amphibian, a flat ship loaded with infantry, standing as they made the trek across the waters from Ireland to the front lines in Italy and North Africa. Due to some misunderstanding, he ended up on the wrong side from where he was supposed to be standing on the boat. And if he had been where he was supposed to be, he would have been among the first killed when that side of the boat exploded as they neared the shore. And when they reached the shore, the back of the ship opened onto the land and the men flooded out. Their regime fought against Rommel, the desert fox. The average life expectancy for a soldier carrying a Browning automatic rifle on the front lines in North Africa was 4 days. They were expected to be among those sacrificed at the start of the war. And my grandpa was on those front lines for over 400 days. He spoke very little about his experience. He told of a shell that went off so close to him that he could feel the concussion rattling his brain. My father said, "Did you kill anyone?" And he said, "I'll tell you this. One night outside my tent, I heard two voices. One said, 'Hey, Fritz,' and the other said, 'Ja, Franz.' And I let loose with a spray of gunfire. And after that, there was only silence." Each of us deserves to be forgiven, if only for our persistence in keeping our small boat afloat when so many others have gone down in the storm. When I think of those boys, those young men standing on the ship from Ireland, how terrified they must have been. All they must have been imagining awaited them. And then how many went down in that storm. My grandpa kept his small boat afloat, but his hands shook every day for the rest of his life. He was the president of the American Legion, and perhaps one of the reasons why the VFW has a bar at their restaurant where they would often gather. So when my dad stood before the draft board during the Vietnam War, one man spoke kindly to him. Four men were silently staring at the table, and the last turned his chair and put his back toward my father, refusing to look at him. He knew, my dad said, what his own father had been through, and that my dad had seen firsthand the effects of war and how that had impacted my grandfather for the rest of his life. My grandfather had been president of the American Legion, but he believed their stance on Vietnam, my country, right or wrong, was wrong. He believed this was not a war to send our children to fight and die for, or to live with the horrors of post-traumatic stress disorder for, and so he resigned his membership. Just prior to the draft board hearing, my dad had read a book about how Scandinavia responded to Nazi invasions in World War II. When the Germans invaded Denmark, oh, you know what? It's somebody's coat. We'll just go on. Okay. This always happens at this point in the story. It's like the big climax. Okay. Just prior to his draft board hearing, my dad had read this book on how Scandinavia responded to the Nazi invasion of World War II. When the Germans invaded Denmark, they did not use violence. They had no military strong enough to stop the Germans, and they did not want to fight. It went off. Okay. So the Danes had no military strong enough to stop the Germans, and they did not want to fight. But this does not mean they did not resist. At night, they would silently lead those among them who were Jewish and send them across the waters to neutral Sweden, keeping those small boats afloat. And so my father spoke to the draft board about nonviolent resistance. And it was Robert Bly who gave my father the information that he was the first in their county to be granted conscientious objector status. And Bly, at the same time, was organizing artists and poets to speak out against the war. We now have a name for PTSD that we did not at the end of World War II. And we have learned that it can cause loss of language, that when someone is triggered by trauma or flashbacks, the connection between the part of the brain that is able to verbalize and speak can get shut down. The part of the brain where new memories are formed can actually shrink, and brain damage literally occurs. We have also learned that one of the things that can help heal that damage is yoga, meditation, things that help our body move and process the buildup of stress hormones that were unable to be released. My grandfather had lost the words to tell what had happened to him, and Bly was using his greatest skill, his weaving of powerful words, to speak when others were left in silence. In addition to having helped put words to the experience of people who had gone through the war, Robert Bly also was responsible for bringing us to greater awareness the works of Rumi, who has become so important to our tradition. One of the best or greatest translators of Rumi is a man named Coleman Barks, who you may have heard of. And Coleman Barks says, "How is it that a young Presbyterian from Chattanooga became a translator of the greatest poet of Islam from the 13th century. He said, Robert Bly handed me in 1976 a volume of translations of Rumi poetry and said, these poems need to be released from their cages. Coleman says, when Rumi spoke, music was always nearby. Music and poetry went hand in hand. For a healthy soul and what an opening heart might be, and for what it is to access an intelligence within and perhaps without our person and personality. So when you asked me, and when John asked me to come and talk about sources of wisdom, I think about those who give words that is breath for our wings. Those who string language into nets that pull us to shore. Those that, as the great Persian poet Hafiz said, pour words into cups that become light, that light our way home. And so Rumi, who gave us the words, come, come, whoever you are, ours is no caravan of despair. There are millions of ways to kneel and kiss the ground. And this being human is a guest house. Those translations came to us through this Western Minnesota path. And Bly said, when you are trying to translate something like that, the poems come deep inside you. The images come deep inside you. You feel yourself, because of the work you've done on the image, invaded by the image. You feel that it has become part of your house, like someone who has moved into your house. And your house is changed then. Your house has changed because these images have come in. And so that's the way I feel about translation. It's a blessing. And that is reminiscent of how I feel about being asked to come here. For a moment, I step out of my food-stained jeans, the mundane daily grind of hustling kids out the door to school and to appointments, running back for a forgotten glove, hoping no one notices that I threw a handful of cornstarch in my hair that I quickly brushed out, hoping no one could tell that it's been a few days since I've washed it. And I go and spend time with these poets and these preachers and imagine your faces and remember the stories you've told with your shells and the stories you've told over coffee, and my house is rearranged by their telling. Like the man who came to me after a service we did on awakening our senses when we had spent some time holding small lumps of clay. He told me he had always been bothered by touching his mother's hand after her death, how cold it had felt. Holding that clay, he realized her body was becoming earth again. You can't help but have your house rearranged when a story like that is told. Coleman Barks says, translating Rumi has opened his heart like a rose. And so I want to close with one more reading through the microphone here. Of Coleman Barks reading that rose poem.
Said to the rose that made it open, was said to me here in my chest. What was told the cypress that made it strong and straight? What was whispered the jasmine, so it is what it is? What made sugarcane sweet. Whatever was said to the inhabitants of the town of Chigil in Turkestan that makes them so handsome. Whatever lets the pomegranate flower blush like a human face, that is being said to me now. I blush. Whatever put eloquence in language, that's happening here. The great warehouse doors open. I fill with gratitude, chewing a piece of sugarcane, in love with the one to whom every that belongs. What was said to the rose that made it open was said to me here in my chest.
Amen.
Thank you, Brianna, for your creative work. Okay. We'll now sing the Blue Boat Home handout, which is right next to you.
You're too exciting for that.
This song. Okay, a few people do. What I'll do is let's go through the first verse twice for people to learn it, and then we'll go on with the last two verses. Okay? Join in whenever you're comfortable. Though below me I feel no motion, standing on these mountains and plains, far away from the rolling ocean, still my dry land heart can say, I've been sailing all my life now, wherever harbor I travel, and the earth is my blue boat home.
One more time, the first verse.
Though below me I feel no motion, standing on these mountains and plains, far away from the rolling ocean, still my dry land heart can say, I've been sailing all my life now, never harbor or port have I known, the wide universe is the ocean I travel. Sail and moon.
the sky, my sailor's song. I was born upon the fathoms. Never harbor or port have I known. The wide universe is the ocean I travel.
Or is this the meditation?
No.
Still doing this? Good. Excellent. So, we'll now have a musical meditation followed by a brief period of silent meditation. Peace.